In a world of globalization, we also find tribalism, fundamentalism, terrorism. And in a world of secularism and great leaps and bounds of science and technology, we find superstition, growing interest in religion, not only in third world countries, but even in today's growing urban centres. Religion hasn't died out as people expected it would or predicted it might. As the world became more modern, religion would be seen as just a stepping stone to the human advance. It hasn't been abandoned, as was predicted, but rather is very strong. So in a world of terrorism and of fundamentalism, the atheist anti-religious authors like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris and Daniel Dennett say religion is not good for the world. And in a world of pluralism and relativism and superstition and growing bodies of conservative religion around the world, the atheist anti-religious writers like Dawkins and Hitchens and Harris and Dennett say religion is not true. They are, of course, separate issues, and so we've tried to deal with them in separate lectures. It could be true that religion has many bad effects, and yet is actually true about the way the world is. There is a God, but belief in God can have bad effects. That's possible. And it's equally possible that religion have many good effects for those who believe it and for societies that embrace it, and yet still be ultimately false. They're separate questions and need to be treated separately. And so tonight we ask the question, is it true? If you missed the lecture on Tuesday, that'll be available very soon at ufcutas.org for download. Let me begin with then, firstly, a word against relativism and respect. A word against relativism and respect. At least in Australia, there's a growing norm which says religion is private, religion is personal, religion is your business, and therefore we should not ask truth questions, public, actual truth questions about religion. And so it is possible to say about religion, that's true for you. It's not true for me, but it is true for you. And in some ways end the discussion there. And so religion becomes this thing which must be respected. It's a thing that is tolerated by refusing to critique. In a sense, tolerance has morphed in meaning from I will put up with your stupid beliefs even though I reckon they're really bad and dumb and I'll tell you so. Now tolerance has kind of morphed and it's become instead I will accept your belief as completely valid and we just won't talk about it. It's true for you. I respect it. And that's that. And it's in reaction to that kind of cultural wave that has hit the shores, to use this appalling metaphor, of our society. It's against that wave that then these writers are saying that's ridiculous. It's nonsense. It's not right. Is religion true or isn't it? We can't just say it's true for you and leave it there. There might be a time for doing that, perhaps, if you're in an awkward conversation around a family Christmas dinner, that you just kind of shut it down that way and leave it there. But you can't just leave it there. There is an elephant in the room when you're sitting next to someone of religious belief or of different religious belief to you. There's a fart in the elevator. And we need to, at some point, acknowledge that fact. Is religion true? Which religion is true? And if it's not true, then it's false, the new atheist writers say. If it's not true, then it's not true. And we should say that it's not true. Let me give you some quotes. The main author I'll be dealing with is Richard Dawkins and his God Delusion. It's probably the most well-known. And rather than jumping across a whole bunch of writers, I thought I'd just deal with one. Let me just give you a couple of examples of how he picks up on this theme and makes the point in some ways, I think, quite well. Firstly, he quotes Douglas Adams, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy guy. So, and the way Douglas Adams makes this point. Religion has certain ideas at the heart of it, which we call sacred or holy or whatever. What it means is, here is an idea or a notion that you're not allowed to say anything bad about. You're just not. Why not? Because you're not. If somebody votes for a party that you don't agree with, you're free to argue about it as much as you like. Everybody will have an argument, but nobody feels aggrieved by it. If somebody thinks taxes should go up or down, you're free to have an argument about it. But on the other hand, if somebody says, I mustn't move a light switch on a Saturday, you say, I respect that. Why shouldn't it be that it's perfectly legitimate to support the Labour Party or the Conservative Party, Republicans or Democrats, this model of economics versus that, Macintosh instead of Windows, but to have an opinion about how the universe began, about who created the universe, no, that's holy. We are used to not challenging religious ideas, but it's very interesting how much of a furor Richard Dawkins creates when he does. Everybody gets absolutely frantic about it, because you're not allowed to say those things. Yet when you look at it rationally, there is no reason why those ideas shouldn't be open to a debate as any other, except that we've agreed somehow that they shouldn't be. It's a truth issue. That rightly should be a truth issue. And we should at some point, as intelligent human beings who are capable of some degree of courtesy to one another, discuss it as a truth issue. Set aside preciousness and respect in some odd way and say, well, is it true? A little later in The God Delusion, Dawkins kind of fuzzes the issue by using the term science to describe it, but makes the point a little differently. He says this, did Jesus have a human father? Was his mother a virgin at the time of his birth? Whether or not there is enough surviving evidence to decide it, this is still a strictly scientific question with a definite answer, yes or no. Did Jesus raise Lazarus from the dead? Did he himself come alive again 3 days after being crucified? There is an answer to every such question, whether or not we can discover it in practice. And it's a scientific answer. That is good. And I think you need to hear that. I think we do need to hear that. I think it's a good point to make, and I think he makes it well. Either Jesus is God, as Christians believe, or he's not God, as atheists and Muslims and Mormons and many others would say. Either his grave was empty 3 days later, and those who then went out to speak about that fact were telling the truth, or his body was what, hidden? Thrown away? Something else happened to the body. But something happened. Either there is a heaven after you die and a hell after you die, or there's not. Let's not hide from important questions like this with the polite relativism forever. We cannot and we must not hide from some of the most fundamental questions about who we are, where we are going, what life's about, just by saying, well, it's true for them. And agnosticism either. Agnosticism. I don't know-ism. Right? That's what it means. There is a time for agnosticism. It's a method. But it's not a creed. It's a method, but it's not a creed. Agnosticism is waiting for more evidence. Agnosticism is a good thing. It's withholding belief. Here's how Dawkins puts it. There's nothing wrong with being agnostic in cases where we lack evidence one way or the other. It's a reasonable position. Carl Sagan was proud to be agnostic when asked whether there was life elsewhere in the universe. When he refused to commit himself, you know, is there aliens or not, someone pressed him for a gut feeling. He replied, I try not to think with my gut. The vision of extraterrestrial life is open. Good arguments can be mounted both ways, and we lack the evidence to do more than shade the probabilities one way or the other. Agnosticism of a kind is an appropriate stance on many scientific questions. But it's a method. It commits you to a quest. It commits you to, in principle, finding an answer. It's what Dawkins calls TAP, temporary agnosticism in practice. TAP. At the moment, I don't have enough evidence, so for the time being, temporarily for the time being, I will withhold belief one way or the other. In practice, as I seek out some kind of answer. But not permanent agnosticism in principle. That's a creed. I don't know, and I've decided I will never know. And in fact, in a sense, I'm not going to want to know. I am now going to not know in principle. I've ruled on the matter. It's unknowable. I share with Dawkins a rejection of that as an approach to life. The more important question, all questions where you might withhold knowledge, you might say, look, in practice, I'm going to be temporarily agnostic and I care so little about it, I'll never really bother to look it up any further. But that's still temporary agnosticism in practice, and it's just practically dismissive. But on the most important questions, I may withhold judgment for a time, but I should be seeking to find an answer as I am able. And even if I can't know, absolutely, it doesn't mean that's it. I need to then work out the burden of proof. I need to work out the evidence that's there. I need to weigh up the options that I have. And so Dawkins can say that his belief is that there is almost certainly no God. Not absolutely. Can we know things absolutely in this kind of realm? Well, probably not. But almost certainly there is no God. There is the room for having to do this, to weigh the evidence, to reflect, to think, to talk, to chew it over, to test things up against each other and work towards knowledge. That might be bad, the arguments against that might be strong, the arguments in favour that might be good, the arguments against that might be bad, and start weighing these things up. So I invite you to do that with me. And the second head, which is clearing out bad arguments, for this is what Dawkins seeks to do, clear out bad arguments for the existence of God. He goes through most of the arguments put forward for God's existence and dismisses them all. The five proofs of Thomas Aquinas, the ontological arguments, subjective arguments from beauty and religious experience, Pascal's wager, an argument from scripture. Interestingly, he doesn't think the argument from evil is a very good one. So unlike some people, and perhaps even some here, he's not particularly convinced that the existence of evil in the world is a strong argument against the existence of God. Let me say a few things about his... of the bad arguments. Number one, generally the tone, and it's part of the style of the book, it's a kind of polemic, preaching, evangelistic tract sort of book, and generally the tone as he approaches the arguments is dismissive, abrupt, even kind of mocking, impatient, I guess is one way you could phrase it. For example, if people say, I believe in God because there's a sublime beauty in the world, he says, well, that's really just jealousy. You're annoyed that someone else could have done something so beautiful or could be so beautiful. And so you go, well, they can't possibly have been capable of it themselves. They must be a god. How dare they do it when I can't? It must be God. Or the ontological argument. He just re-scripts it as a playground squabble. Aquinas' fourth proof is answered with simply, that's an argument. That's the kind of tone he takes. Second, he has been rightly criticised by many writers, rightly criticised, I think, for carelessness in this area. There's a book written, I'm not sure if by a Christian actually, but by an author named Margaret Midgley, I think an anthropologist, who has reflected on a whole range of popular scientific works. This, I think, came out well before the God Delusion. And she reflected how many popular scientific works have good science right up until the last chapter. And in the last chapter, we find the scientist stepping outside their speciality and presuming to hold forth on philosophy, meaning of life, and in general, kind of fail once they step outside their speciality. It's one of those examples of stepping outside the area of expertise, and as a result, failing to understand the subtleties, and so being dismissive of them, failing to recognise the nuances and so just sort of sweeping them away. And we'll return to some examples of that. Three, what he's seeking to do in his program is actually not what one of the great Christian theologians, Thomas Aquinas, was seeking to do with his arguments for the existence of God. Or really what most Christian philosophers and stuff are doing with their arguments for the existence of God. Dawkins is actually doing something different and judging them for something different. He's judging them for not being able to prove and serve up onto the plate an absolute kind of look. If you accept all these premises, bam, you're down. And criticising them on those grounds. But that's not quite what any kind of developed Christian philosophy is trying to do. Let me read to you from one of the critiques of the God delusion. It's called provocatively the Dawkins delusion, and it's by a fellow Oxford fellow, Alistair McGrath. And here's what he writes about Dawkins on this point of, you know, the arguments for the existence of God. At no point does Thomas Aquinas speak of these as being proofs for God's existence. Rather, they are to be seen as a demonstration of the inner coherence of belief in God. Aquinas is interested in exploring the rational implications of faith in terms of our experience of beauty, causality, and so forth. Belief in God is assumed. It is then shown that this belief makes sense of what may be observed within the world. It's a different project, you see. It's saying, step inside a Christian outlook and then see how it puts together the information that we receive around us. The appearance of design can offer persuasion, but not proof, concerning the role of divine creativity and so on. Dawkins misunderstands an a posteriori demonstration for the coherence of faith to be an a priori proof of faith. So it's a stepping out here and looking and gleaning and inducting from that that faith might be justified, rather than working from first principles. Because this and this, therefore absolutely it must, and everyone must agree absolutely. He's confused the two. It's an entirely understandable mistake for those new to this field, but it is a serious mistake nonetheless. Where Dawkins sees faith as intellectual nonsense, most of us are aware that we hold many beliefs that we cannot prove to be true, but are nonetheless perfectly reasonable to entertain. To lapse into jargon for a moment, our beliefs may be shown to be justifiable, without therefore demonstrating they are proven. Philosophers of science have long made the point there are many scientific theories that are presently believed to be true but may have to be discarded in the future as new evidence emerges. Dawkins' point of view, you see, he's also beginning with some of these assumptions he's already adopted and is working from those, just as Aquinas or Alvin Plantinga, to use an example of a modern Christian philosopher, will begin with a worldview, a bunch of assumptions and axioms such as, you know, 1 plus 1 equals 2, and that I exist, and that my memory works, and there's an external world, and so on, and there's a God. Dawkins is also beginning with a set of axioms that are kind of, that you begin with them, you bring them to the party, you can't get outside of them. And one of the things that Dawkins brings to the table is that the only truths that can be believed, the only convincing truths that can be believed, are empirically testable truths. That's one of his starting points. Now, that axiom itself cannot be empirically proved. You can't do an experiment to begin with that. That's a starting point. It's a valid one. It's a common sense one, we might say. That we begin and just kind of open our eyes and try and do it as if for the first time, and then say, okay, if that's where I begin, what's reasonable to believe? That's the starting point. That seems like very common sense. Although it seems like that to us who have been raised in a tradition that at least since the 17th century has begun formulating that approach. So what might seem like common sense to all people may just seem to be common sense to a particular niche. But it is a philosophical decision, and in a sense a dangerous one, because it's saying, in a sense, all that is true that is worth believing will also be conveniently able to be tested or believed if you begin from the starting point of just opening your eyes and seeing what you can believe. Now, there might be some things that are true and rational and reasonable that are not conveniently testable in that way. So you've made a move there, and you've said, all the truth that is knowable, all the truth that is worth knowing, is accessible through conveniently repeatable experiment. It's an assumption, and it's a philosophical assumption, and it's an assumption that in fact rules out certain things more or less. It becomes almost impossible to actually accept the existence of miracles, actually accept the existence of the belief in God, because it would be deemed better to just withhold judgment and expect that eventually we'll find an empirical explanation. So you would be left watching Jesus rise out of the grave, having been crucified before your very eyes, and having to say, yeah, no, I'm sure there's a rational explanation. There's a series of ways of looking at things. Add to this Darwinism, which Dawkins picks up from another writer, Daniel Dennett, in his book Darwin's Dangerous Idea, he calls a consciousness razor. He works it by analogy. You see, what Darwinism has been able to do and introduce, when an atheist approaches Darwinism at least, what it seems to be able to do is this. Darwinian evolution, specifically natural selection, does something more. It shatters the illusion of design within the domain of biology. And then he works by analogy. And so it teaches us to be suspicious of any design hypothesis in physics and in cosmology as well. So he's actually, in a sense, a philosophical natural selectionist. Very urgent. He's got some stocks. They're plummeting. he's actually one of the Christians as well. Thanks for your support, mate. he's taking what Darwinism is able to do in explaining what seems to be design as as actually just a result of natural forces, and says, well, that's the way we should look at everything, that eventually there will be an explanation by natural forces. It's a consciousness raiser, he says. It's something, it's an assumption, but it brings you to always be sceptical of design in any form. Into the knockdown argument. This is the third big head for the lecture. The ultimate Boeing 747 argument is really built on this consciousness raiser. His ultimate Boeing 747 argument. Powerful argument, Dawkins writes, which does not depend upon subjective judgment. It's the argument from improbability. It really does transport us dramatically away from 50% agnosticism, far towards the extreme of theism, in the view of many theists, but I say towards the extreme of atheism, in my view. I've alluded to it several times already, and the argument turns on the familiar question, who made God, which most thinking people discover for themselves. A designer God cannot be used to explain organized complexity, because any God capable of designing anything would have to be complex enough to demand the same kind of explanation in his own right. A designer God cannot be used to explain organized complexity, because any God capable of designing anything would have to be complex enough to demand the same kind of explanation in his own right. Explanation. But it's not one that is ever rational to accept, because it's just asks more questions than it answers. You take a complex universe and then you add on top of it a God who seems even more complex still, and you haven't really seemed to move anywhere, Dawkins would say. The logic builds on that kind of premise that has sometimes been called Occam's razor, where you don't multiply explanations beyond what's necessary. You go for the simplest, most elegant explanation whenever you can. If we can explain boiling water simply in terms of the movement of molecules and so on, then why add into it microscopic green gnomes who push them around with pool cues? What does it add to the explanation? Don't multiply things beyond what is necessary. Because every complication reminds more explanation. And in Dawkins' view, God must be a very complex being. He writes, a God capable of continuously monitoring and controlling the individual status of every particle in the universe cannot be simple. His existence is going to need a mammoth explanation in its own right. Worse, other corners of God's giant consciousness are simultaneously preoccupied with the doings and emotions and prayers of every single human being. And whatever intelligent aliens there might be in other planets, in this and 100 billion other galaxies. He even, according to one philosopher, Richard Swinburne, has to decide continuously not to intervene miraculously to save us when we get cancer. That would never do, for if God answered most prayers for a relative to recover from cancer, then cancer would no longer be a problem for humans to solve, and then what would we be able to do with our time then? At another point, he simply sighs and says, God is able to do all these things simultaneously. He cannot be whatever else he might be. Simple. What bandwidth? God may not have a brain made of neurons or a CPU made of silicon, but if he has the powers attributed to him, he must have something far more elaborately and non-randomly constructed than the largest brain or the largest computer that we know. If we can get a simpler explanation, he says, shouldn't we go for it? Is there a simpler explanation? Dawkins floats up a few and says, I guess we'll find out over time, but any of these would be better. Multiple parallel universes, perhaps universes in sequence, you know, crushing and banging and crushing and banging. Some kind of evolutionary relationship between universes that just by the sheer rolling the die over and over again, eventually we'll expect to find a universe as ordered and structured as ours. In a sense, it's looking at applying the evolution analogy to everything. Surely that would be better. Even if we have no evidence for it yet, surely from a blank slate, it's a better starting point. Because still, even if you've got lots and lots of universes, isn't it all still natural, testable? It's the same kind of stuff. You're not adding a new type of stuff, angels and God and things. You're just adding more of what we've already got. But whatever we might suggest, he writes, it would be better to remain agnostic about the exact explanation, but very suspicious of the God explanation. Dawkins. I'm not sure if I need those things yet. Let me just work through. I've got a list of points, and I think it's probably in some ways the most helpful just to work through the five headings that I have that really tease out Christian reflection and response to what Dawkins puts forward. Let's see how we go with that. One, the ultimate Boeing 747 argument fails for three reasons. Reason one, if you're going to engage with the suggestion that God is the origin of all things, then part of the view you are engaging with is a God who is a self-existent, self-explaining being. That's part of the view you're critiquing. You can't kind of step in and critique a part of the view and not the whole view. The Christian is saying the origin of the universe is a God who, part of the meaning of that word is self-existent and self-explaining. That's just a basic part of what the claim, at least the Christian claim of belief is. So to then respond, so who created this self-existent being? It's a non-response. It's not listening. To say, who explains this self-defining, self-explaining ground of all being? It's just not listening. Simple explanation. Because the explanation is God did it. It's not God plus the green goblins, plus this, plus that, plus the other. It's God did it. Now, the mechanics of the explanation may be complicated, vastly complicated. But the explanation itself is simple. It's an important difference, isn't it? You may come up with a theory that explains massive new elements of scientific knowledge and phenomena that we've been wrestling with and deals with exceptions that otherwise were always a little bit embarrassing. You come up with this massive new theory. It explains it all. It's simple. And it introduces a whole bunch of new concepts and struggles and ideas and theories and sub-particles of something and blobs and so on. It might introduce new complexities. But the explanation that it gives is a simple one. You've got to separate those two out. What the explanation itself may imply from the actual force of the explanation itself. Moreover, God is a simple explanation because limitlessness brings with it simplicity. Richard Swinburne, who Dawkins responded to before, has written a large philosophical textbook, The Existence of God, and argues the point that in terms of simplicity, that is the most simple explanation you can get is nothing. Nothing doesn't need an explanation because it's not. The next most simple explanation is boundlessness, infinity. Because anything in between forces you to ask, why only so much and not more? Why not larger? Why not smaller? Why stop there? And so to have a vast, infinite, all-powerful, all-knowing, all-present being who is ultimate, necessary, absolute being is a very graceful, simple explanation. Each of his qualities matches each of his thoughts, matches each of his deeds fully. There is an extreme simplicity and grace to the existence of God, which leads to the third reason, which is that God isn't made out of, as he says, silicon chips or brains or anything of the kind. Part of the view that, again, Dawkins is engaging with is that God is spirit without parts and passions and body and all this kind of stuff. That we're dealing with a being who is pure action, intention, thought. And so we've just got to let go of the analogy of brain, of computer, of thought neuron, and of the assumption that it must be something similar. We're not dealing with something anywhere near analogy to our concrete world. The ultimate Boeing 747 argument, for all the build-up it gets until it is unveiled for us, is just really a bit bemusing to the Christian thinker. Oh, is that it? Important, as I've said, to recognise that empiricism is a presupposition and so level the playing field. To recognise that this starting point of scientific naturalism, of empiricism, of let's begin with just what is reasonable to know, if I just begin with a single human knower opening their eyes and reasoning what is reasonable to know, recognising that that itself is a philosophical assumption, a leap of faith, if you like, levels the playing field, importantly. It cuts out the rhetoric in the book, which assumes that all thinking people would, if not blinded by superstition or social pressure or influence from your parents, you would also admit. Isn't it clear that all we need to see is? It cuts out that kind of starting point. Dawkins says it's a red herring at a certain point in the book, that it's philosophical amateurs who raise this, and that we all believe in evidence. But it misses the point. It missed the point, I think, of this stuff, that the assumption that this is all, and the perspective that therefore filters other things out, that is not something that everyone believes in. It is equally valid, as some very renowned, not just kind of fringe philosophers in some kind of Christian kind of sub-world, but very renowned modern philosophers have written at length saying that it is just as reasonable, just as justifiable, just as rational to begin with God as an axiom. And in fact, it has certain strengths. If God begins with us as an axiom, it means we are right to trust reason, We are right to believe in some degree of moral worth and value and purpose. If God is an axiom, we are right to see that this world is explainable. Explain something from scientific point of view doesn't mean that that is a full explanation. It doesn't mean it's a true explanation. It is just an explanation. The late 19th and early 20th century was full of a particular kind of sort of quaint modernistic scientism that we look at now, and it sounds a little odd when you listen to it, doesn't it? That kind of, science has proved absolutely that now people will soon be able to fly to the moon and live off apple juice, you know, and this sort of thing. And it sounds a little odd, quirky, bizarre, as you read it and look back on it now, as maybe you walk through, you know, maybe the pharmacy school or something in the uni, and you see these kind of, new elixir, it is bound to prove everything and heal all, and, you know, this kind of thing, right? But a certain kind of that kind of theory would just say we could explain everything scientifically. We can come up with a scientific theory that will explain everything. And the assumption was, therefore, if it sounds scientific, it must be true. There's a difference between a theory phrased in scientific terms and truth. What factors that lead to religious belief? Of course, there are factors that lead to non-religious belief by the same token. We could explain both phenomena sociologically, but that doesn't mean we have explained them fully. Philosophical arguments aren't proofs, but they are significant. So they aren't knock-down proofs for anyone from any starting point, but they are significant. And they are, I think, justifiable pause for thought. Long, hard thought. They are cause to stop and maybe be willing to step back from my own hunch and belief, whether it's because my parents raised me that way, or whether I like the idea of this particular belief and what it permits me to do or comforts me in, to step back from what I might already hold and just ask, what if? To allow myself to feel the force, what if? The fact that anything exists, for example, where did anything come from? Where did stuff come from? It is well explained by a creator God who made it all. That life in particular exists, and life with consciousness as advanced and as complex and as multifaceted as human consciousness exists, calls for some kind of explanation. It's remarkable that we live in a universe that supports life. It's remarkable that life then actually happened in it. In fact, it's remarkable we live in a universe that supports planets or stars or anything. Dawkins refers to what kind of cosmologists talk about as the Goldilocks theory, that the universe was just right. Not too hot, not too cold. Certain constants that just were just so. So that we actually ended up with either not just kind of dust blowing out everywhere or a big lump of glob or just collapse back into itself. But instead we have a universe that's stable, that forms stars, forms planets. Planets that then somehow become amenable to life, and then somehow, and no one has a good explanation at the moment for how life comes about. And then that life itself becomes so vastly complex, and then it includes something that is, again, hard to pin down, human consciousness. That calls for an explanation. It calls for pause, for thought at least, doesn't it? It calls for a little bit of humility from an atheist who's got to come, got to at least say, yeah, okay, the theist might have a point there. I could see how they would conclude thoughtfully that that's the case. That there is meaning and value and morality, and that even the atheist writers can speak with such outrage and moral indignation at things that are horrible and vicious and awful and tragic in the world. The fact we have a sense of goodness and value and importance. Where does that come from? What makes it so vivid and real and intuitively absolute? If there is a God as a ground of meaning and value and purpose a personal centre of the universe, then that's why we have this intuition for meaning and value and purpose, human rights, kindness to our friends, value of true love, outrage at abuse and torture of those who are innocent. We have those things because they are real as matter. If there is no personal ground to the universe, then they're kind of illusion. And at best, they are a phenomena of the human society. They're not ultimately valuable things. They just happen to happen. Arguments. You could give other explanations for all of them. Empirical, Darwinist ones, Buddhist ones, Dreamtime ones. But I find the argument of God's existence extremely compelling. The 4-7 argument has problems. Empiricism is a proposition, and that at least levels the playing field. Philosophical arguments have their place. Four, and here I think Dawkins is at his weakest, the Bible's view of the world has intuitive fit and strong explanatory power. The way the Bible describes what God is like is unique amongst world religions and is striking and beautiful. I mean, you can mock the Trinity as being something which is hard to pin down, but the explanatory power and the cohesiveness it gives within a Christian view is beautiful, to say the least. A God who is both transcendent and beyond, but also relational and personal. A humanity who are valuable and made in God's image to love and respond to each other, to worship God and serve his world. A fall of humanity which explains what is wrong with the world, which both grants human freedom and accountability without giving in to, and doesn't give in to some kind of fatalism or despair. Doesn't let us off the hook as just, oops, we accidentally did it and we didn't mean to. The message of salvation by grace, coming by God's initiative, taking on our nature to die in our place, not human effort as if somehow we climb enough steps and eat the right diet and pray the right prayers, we might somehow please God once more. There are differences to the Christian biblical worldview which are strikingly different to world religions. And sometimes are inconvenient teachings. They're not what we would like to believe if we had to think up the God we'd like to believe in. The Trinity is annoying because it's hard to tie down. The message of salvation by grace alone is humiliating because it's not my religious devoutness which earns God's favour, but it's purely by God's stooping down to save. The difficulties caused in wrestling with Christian doctrine are challenges and are unique in their presentation amongst world religions. But it's a compelling and convincing worldview, and I think often it is sadly mocked with so little understanding of it. One of the reasons why we just do a lot of Bible teaching and sermons in a university campus setting, because we're dealing with a lot of extremely intelligent, thoughtful people who, by and large, are biblically illiterate. And so to even begin to have a conversation about religion, we've got to, in a sense, step right back and get a feel for what Christianity even has to say. Five, the Jesus event itself is very hard to explain away. Who was Jesus? He was. He existed. And it's rare to find people who would deny it. He worked wonders, whatever they were, whether legitimate or not, and he made claims in his teaching far more than merely moral claims, but claims about his central importance as the agent of God in bringing about God's reign on earth. His teaching was not just moral, but it was self-focused. He saw himself, his early followers wrote about him as God, to be worshipped and to be prayed to, and to be served. These things in all but the fringes of history and theology are pretty standard things. His followers claimed his grave was empty. As far as we can see, even the opponents of those philosophers had to admit his grave was empty 3 days after killed by Pontius Pilate. His followers claimed that they'd seen him risen from the dead, convinced masses of people right to the centres of civilization of the day, were willing to hold to those claims at the point of immense suffering and martyrdom, spawned a new form of religious thought in continuity with Judaism, but not what you would expect a first century Jew to come up with. A very important model work is by an English writer, N.T. Wright, The Resurrection of the Son of God, where he argues at massive length that the Christian theology that we have in the New Testament is both startlingly unified, startlingly connected to the Old Testament, but so surprisingly different that we just cannot say, well, of course they imagined that Jesus rose from the dead. Faced with the disappointment of his crucifixion, of course they would come up with that. He makes a very strong case that even their theology itself is very, very hard to explain. These points, not their interpretation, but the point that these are facts we have to deal with about Jesus, are not just Christian points. They're just points that, again, all but fringes of both Christian and non-Christian writers will give assent to. And they're points that we need to have an explanation about, because it's not every man and his dog who can present this sort of picture of the foundation of a religion. It's not common for religions to start this way. It's not common for religions to spread so rapidly that they absorb the Roman Empire within 4 centuries without some kind of war or crusade. It is very unusual, extremely unusual. One non-Christian historian has even said there is a resurrection-shaped hole in history. What we have surrounding Jesus, his life, his teaching, his death, his... it would be well explained by a resurrection. Because I'm convinced that there is a God who created everything, who rules everything, against whom all of us, including the Christians, have rebelled. We all stand guilty before him and we all face punishment before him. But that same God truly did enter history as a man, died as a substitute for us, for our guilt, for our deservings, and he rose as now the King and the Saviour, the Forgiver, and the one who will actually guarantee a new world for you and for me, who now commands all to respond to him by turning to him, worshipping him, depending upon him for life and for afterlife. At the very least, if that's very true, if that is true, then the cost of walking away from it, being smug about it, being dismissive about it, the cost is very high. If it's true, it would be awesome if there was life forever. That would be fantastic. That actually all the things we feel guilty about could be forgiven. And that God actually loves us as a father and wants to accept. That is very, very good, if it were true. Jesus' challenge to us, as we find in Luke 17, is the thought that we might end this life and see that it's all true and then turn to God and say, can someone back to tell my family, my friends, my loved ones that it's all true? And in the parable Jesus tells in Luke 17, he says, well, I've got the scriptures. If they don't believe the scriptures, they're not going to believe even if someone raises from the dead. That might be true. It might be true that you won't believe even if God did appear right now and pull a giraffe out your nose and fly around the room. It's an inconvenient truth. It's an invasive truth. It has implications for what you're going to do for the rest of your life. There is so much at stake, however. There is great danger. If it's true and I walk away from it, there is great hope and great blessing if it is true and I embrace it.